Welcome to today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Jim Mitchell, your volunteer broadcaster here on Sun Sounds of Arizona, and these are the journal's business and finance headlines for Friday, January 17th, 2025. Mortgage rates rose above 7% for the first time since mid-2024, an early setback for a housing market that's coming off two consecutive years of poor sales. China said its economy expanded by 5% last year, hitting its official growth target. But a variety of weak signals raised skepticism among some outside economists. A rule change last year by California's insurance regulator will likely shift a large portion of the cost of the Los Angeles fires to homeowners in the state. Declines in tech stocks depressed U.S. indices, and Treasury yields fell for a third straight session. The S&P 500 and Dow both declined 0.2%, and the Nasdaq shed 0.9%. The 10-year Treasury note settled at 4.606%. Retail sales in November and December, excluding cars, gasoline, and restaurants, rose 4% from 2023 to $994.1 billion U.S. dollars, Commerce Department data showed. Cartier owner Richemont reported better-than-expected quarterly sales, triggering a rally in luxury stocks after its jewelry division bucked a downturn in demand for high-end goods. TSMC reported another record quarter on AI-driven demand for chips and said it expects continued growth even as it navigates the U.S.-China technology rivalry. And American Express agreed to pay about $230 million in penalties over deceptive practices tied to how it sold credit cards and wire services to small business customers. First, let's take a look at the markets with this article. Tech stocks pressure U.S. indices, rate cut hopes boost treasuries. Declines in technology stocks dragged on major indices, while treasury yields dropped for the third straight session. A day after stocks and bonds got a big lift from encouraging inflation data, it was a quieter session in markets. Despite gains in 8 of its 11 sectors, the S&P 500 fell by 0.2%, weighed down by losses among the largest tech names. The tech-heavy Nasdaq Composite shed 0.9%, while the Dow Industrial Average slipped 0.2%. Among individual companies, Apple fell 4%. Tesla lost 3.4%, and Amazon.com dropped 1.2%. With the inflation data coming out a little better than expected, investors breathed a sigh of relief, short sellers had to cover, and today I think there's probably a little bit of profit-taking, said Sam Stovall, chief investment strategist at CFRA Research. Bonds fared better than stocks after Federal Reserve Governor Christopher Waller said it is reasonable to think that the central bank could cut interest rates in the first half of the year. The yield on the benchmark 10-year U.S. Treasury note settled at 4.606%, according to TradeWeb, down from 4.653% on Wednesday. Yields, which rise when bond prices fall, climbed sharply in recent weeks because of strong economic data and uncertainty about the impact of President-elect Donald Trump's populist policy agenda. Elsewhere, global markets climbed. The Stoxx Europe 600 rose, boosted by luxury stocks. Germany's DAX closed at a record, while France's CAC 40 jumped 2.1%. In Asia, the Hang Seng Index and the Nikkei 225 gained. The yen rallied against the dollar after the Bank of Japan's governor repeated a pledge to discuss an interest rate increase. That was tech stocks pressure U.S. indices, rate cut hopes boost treasuries. Next, we'll move from markets to mortgages with this article. Mortgage rates surpass 7% in new blow to home market by Gina Heave and Nicole Friedman. Mortgage rates rose above 7% for the first time since mid-2024, an early setback for a housing market that's coming off two consecutive years of poor sales. The average rate on the standard 30-year fixed mortgage rose to 7.04% this week, according to a survey of lenders by mortgage finance giant Freddie Mac. That marked the first time since May that it rose above 7%, an important psychological threshold for buyers and sellers. Unfortunately, we're at that point again, said Calvin Lawhorn, president of Lawhorn & Associates Mortgage, where purchase and refinance volumes were down 20% from a year earlier in 2024. The housing market has slumped in recent years as high mortgage rates and expensive home prices made home buying unaffordable for many people in the U.S. It hasn't helped that other costs of home ownership, such as insurance and taxes, have also surged. Sales of previously owned homes in 2024 likely fell to the lowest level since 1995 for the second year in a row. An uptick in rates to start the year could put a damper on the spring selling season, usually the most active for sales, and undermine hopes that the market can break out of its sales slump. The Federal Reserve last month again lowered its benchmark interest rate for the third time in a year, which brought it down a full percentage point in September, but the central bank signaled doubt over its future path. Mortgage rates aren't directly tied to those moves and instead tend to move with government bond yields. The 10-year Treasury yield retreated Wednesday and Thursday, but that's been on the rise in recent weeks, a reflection of uncertainty over inflation, the federal budget deficit, and other factors. The upward drift in mortgage rates, the result of ongoing financial market volatility and inflationary pressure, is dampening home buyer demand, said Bob Brooksmith, president and chief executive officer of the Mortgage Bankers Association. Housing executives and economists have incorrectly predicted in recent years that mortgage rates would come down. In early 2023 and early 2024, slight rate declines boosted optimism for an active spring selling season. Those lower rates didn't last. A temporary decline in mortgage rates last summer and fall to just above 6% also fueled hopes for recovery in the beaten-down housing market. Sales of existing homes rose in November, notching the biggest year-over-year gain in more than 3 years as buyers took advantage of the dip in borrowing costs. But the rebound proved short-lived. Only 6 months ago, many predicted that interest rates would be reduced slowly through 2025 and mortgage rates would reach the mid-to-high 5% range, said Selma Hepp, chief economist at CoreLogic. That outlook has changed tremendously. Rates add up quickly when it comes to mortgages. A difference of a few percentage points can translate to hundreds of thousands of dollars in interest over the lifespan of a 30-year loan. In a September survey of more than 1,000 homeowners and renters, 70% said that the highest mortgage rate they would accept was 5.49% or lower, according to John Burns Research and Consulting. Still, some buyers have to move and won't be deterred by mortgage rates. Wendy Monday and her husband closed last month on a home in Nashville, Tennessee, with a mortgage rate of about 6.6%. The couple didn't want to wait and liked the location next to a school where they planned to send their 3-year-old. Monday, a real estate broker herself, also expects home prices to continue to rise. I was pretty certain that if we waited until next year, we'd have ended up paying more, she said. But many would-be homebuyers have remained stuck on the sidelines, hoping that rates will come down. And changes to the rules for how real estate agents get paid have also increased uncertainty for some home shoppers. Would-be sellers who got mortgages before the Fed started to raise rates from ultra-low levels have continued to feel locked in place, keeping supply below historical norms. But some sellers who've been waiting for rates to fall have decided they can't keep waiting, and the inventory of homes for sale has risen from a year-ago levels. Tasha Hubner in trying to sell her four-bedroom house in Silverton, Oregon, because she wants to move back to the Midwest. Buyers have shown little interest even after Huebner cut the price. "It's really dead," she said. "There's so much uncertainty with mortgage rates." That was Mortgage Rates Surpass 7% in New Blow to Home Market. Let's turn to bonds from mortgages with this article, "Bond Investors Wrestle with Higher Yields Amid Uncertainty," by Paolo Trevisani. Bond investors are in for a bumpier ride than usual, as Treasury yields are expected to move sharply in the coming weeks on the heels of an unpredictable Trump administration and economic data on growth, jobs, and inflation. The 10-year yield traded between 4% and 4.5% for most of the fourth quarter before moving higher after the Federal Reserve indicated in December that it would pause its cuts in interest rates. The benchmark remains near its highest level since November of 2023. Yields fell sharply on Wednesday to settle at around 4.7% after consumer inflation broadly met expectations of resilient prices. That was after yields rallied last week on stronger-than-expected job creation in December. On Thursday, Treasury yields edged lower. The oscillating flow of data, paired with doubts about how President-elect Donald Trump's policies will affect prices and employment, makes it harder to forecast Fed moves and, consequently, Treasury yields. Forecasts for the 10-year range from a drop below 4% to a rise above 5%. Resilient economic data are behind the sustained growth in yields, aided by Trump's promised tariffs and immigration policies. Investors worry the new policies will boost inflation, which could jolt markets after Monday's inauguration. The market continues to be a little bit nervous, and there is still uncertainty about the actual policies of the new administration, said Danny Zaid, a portfolio manager at 24 Asset Management. For now, markets are mostly betting on at least one Fed cut this year, keeping rates above what was forecast a few months ago when more trimming was priced into the equation. That, in turn, keeps bond yields elevated. Zaid said the 10-year may reach 5% this year. He believes yields at this level make bonds an attractive option for investors. He expects yields to lose steam, but for now, the economy has been able to withstand the elevated rates, and the Fed can keep rates on hold, he said. The uncertainty comes as the Fed steers away from any guidance other than just telling markets its next decision will depend on the coming data. An aggressive rate-cutting phase launched in September as prices and employment cooled is now forecast to slow down, with a pause this month and little certainty about future moves. Bank of America foresees the 10-year Treasury yield ending this year and the next at 4.75%, up from 4.25% in the previous forecast. Its economists wrote on a Monday report that they expect the Fed to be, quote, on an extended hold. They see risks more skewed to a hike versus a cut. But there's a divergence. T.S. Lombard expects the benchmark to rise above 5%. Wells Fargo forecasts a decline to 4.25%. Navalier and Associates expect it to fall below 4% in a few months. The increase in yields so far means that bond prices, which move in the opposite direction, are low. Lisa Shallett, an economist at Morgan Stanley, says now's the time to buy them. Consider using the Treasury sell-off as an entry point for building positions in credit and spread products, she said Monday. That was Bond Investors Wrestle with Higher Yields Amid Uncertainty. Next, Owners Across California Liable for Fires Cost, by Gene Inglesham and Sarah Randazzo. A little-noticed rule change last year by California's insurance regulator will likely shift a large chunk of the cost of the Los Angeles fires to homeowners across the state. Pushed by insurers, the changes put California homeowners on the hook to pay directly toward the cost of rebuilding from very large disasters, though even fatter insurance bills, whether they were exposed to the LA fire or not. That would be a huge wake-up call for Californians because they have no idea that the rules have changed, said David Jones, a former California insurance commissioner. The new policy affects the backstop for California's FAIR Plan, the state's insurer of last resort, which sells fire damage policies to homeowners who can't get coverage elsewhere. The worry is that the FAIR Plan lacks the resources to pay for the quickly escalating costs of the fires, which have destroyed tens of thousands of structures. The rules change means insurance companies can bill their customers if they are forced to bail out the plan, which has an estimated $200 million in cash and $2.5 billion in reinsurance, according to data reported last year. That is likely not enough to cover the FAIR Plan's share of the losses from the fires, forecast at up to $6 billion by analysts at Evercore ISI. The FAIR Plan's business ballooned after private insurers pulled back from the state, preparing for a disaster by not renewing policies as their risk models warned of likely conflagrations. As the blazes spread, estimates of the financial toll keep rising. Analysts at Morningstar DBRS now forecast insured losses up to $30 billion, the highest for any fire in the world in recent times. Private insurers have sufficient resources to cover the expected claims, and none are expected to be pushed into insolvency by the disaster, analysts said. But the spiraling cost could financially overwhelm the FAIR Plan, the government-created insurance safety net. Like similar insurance safety nets in more than 30 other states, including disaster-prone places like Florida, the FAIR Plan wasn't set up as a typical insurer. It operates with little cash in the bank as a way of keeping rates, while higher than private insurers' premiums, within reach of policyholders. Regulated insurers agree to bail out the plan, if needed, as part of doing business in the state. The FAIR Plan is required to take all comers, which means its customers are heavily concentrated in fire-prone areas. A heap of charred rubble marks where Henry and Brenda Sharp's $2 million Altadena building once stood. The couple, in their 70s, are scrambling to figure out their losses and how much their insurer, the FAIR Plan, will pay. It's burned down, Brenda Sharp said of their three-bedroom, three-bath home and three rental units on the property. Our whole neighborhood burned down. In the Sharps Altadena zip code alone, the plan has insured almost $1 billion of properties at the end of September, up 47% from the previous year, the data shows. If the FAIR Plan breaches its financial resources, the state can call on commercial home insurers to pay the rest of the claims by imposing what's called an assessment on the companies. The charge on each company will be roughly proportionate to its share of the home insurance market. The largest home insurers include State Farm, Farmers Insurance, Allstate, and Mercury Insurance. If the FAIR Plan loses more than $2.5 billion, it will likely need that assessment, said Michael Wera, director of the Climate and Energy Policy Program at Stanford University. It's very likely they've lost more than $2.5 billion, he said. A spokesman for the FAIR Plan said it's too early to determine if an assessment will be sought as claims are just beginning to be submitted and processed. Because of the rule change made last year by the state's embattled insurance commissioner, Richard Lara, companies can add to their customers' bills 50% of the first $1 billion of an assessment and 100% of amounts over that, subject to his agreement. An assessment would put further upward pressure on California's already fast-rising home insurance rates, according to analysts. Most of those affected have suffered total losses. Carl Sussman, a Los Angeles-based insurance agent, said 78 and counting of his clients in the Pacific Palisades, one of the FAIR Plan's biggest markets, have nothing left. One client's family has been left with the clothes on their back and a laptop that was in their car as they fled the flames, Sussman said. The FAIR plan was set up in the 1960s when the Watts riots led to widespread fire damage in Los Angeles, prompting commercial insurers to pull away from the market. The plan was initially intended to cover only a fraction of homeowners. It's taken on an outsized role as private insurers have curbed coverage. 7 of the 12 biggest home insurers in the state have stopped or restricted sales of new policies, saying the rates allowed by regulators are insufficient to compensate for wildfire and other losses. The FAIR plan, intended as a last resort, is quickly moving to be the first resort for a lot of people, its president, Victoria Roach, said in a hearing last year. For years, the industry had lobbied lawmakers to allow companies to pass on any FAIR plan assessments to policyholders without success. Last year, regulator Laura changed the assessment rules, part of a broader push to persuade leading home insurers to return to the fragile market. Insurers had a wish list of things, and they got them all, including reducing their exposure to California FAIR plan assessments, said Jones, who heads the Climate Risk Initiative at the University of California, Berkeley's Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment. As well as passing on costs to homeowners, insurers might be able to further reduce the pain of any assessment through reinsurance. Mercury, one of the top 10 insurers in the state, said Friday it expects its losses to exceed the $150 million level at which its reinsurance kicks in. That reinsurance covers the FAIR plan assessments, the company said. Consumer advocates are up in arms about the prospect of a potential charge of hundreds or even thousands of dollars being added to home insurance bills. Homeowners across the state shouldn't pay because insurance companies dumped homeowners on the FAIR plan, said Carmen Barber, the Los Angeles-based executive director of Consumer Watchdog. Rules were changed last year to give consumers certainty because we knew it was a matter of when, not if, there were going to be a major wildfire, said Michael Soler, a deputy California insurance commissioner. Any assessment would need to be approved by the commissioner, he said. We don't know yet if we're at an extreme worst-case scenario, he said. It's possible the state could bail out the plan. A proposal from lawmakers would empower the California Infrastructure and Economic Development Bank to issue bonds to raise cash for the plan. The FAIR plan could also seek to recover money paid out in claims by suing utilities that can be shown to have sparked one or more of the fires. The sheer volume of likely claims on the already stretched FAIR plan means victims of the fire could well face delays and bureaucratic tangles trying to get paid, agents and consumer advocates have said. The Sharps say they're talking to their insurance broker and haven't yet submitted a claim. They hope to remain in the area, even if they decide not to rebuild their home. Our children and grandchildren are there. Our church is there. Our life is there, Brenda Sharp said. Out of our church family, there have been over 60 families who've lost their homes to these fires. That was Owners Across California Liable for Fires Cost. My happier note, Holiday Spending Cheers Retailers by Suzanne Kapner and Sarah Nassauer. Consumers snapped up Cartier jewelry and toys at Target this holiday season, powering through concerns about high inflation and the U.S. job market. Retail sales in November and December, excluding automobiles, gas, and restaurants, increased 4% from 2023 to $994.1 billion, according to the U.S. Commerce Department. And that was above the National Retail Federation's estimate of 2.5% to 3.5% growth. Online sales rose 8.6%, the NRF said, in line with the trade group's estimate of an 8 to 9% increase. The sales, which aren't adjusted for inflation, reflected a return of more than normal levels of growth following the COVID-19 pandemic, when pent-up demand led to big gains in 2020 and 2021. It's not a blowout year, said Craig Johnson, the president of research firm Custom Growth Partners, but it is a good year. A handful of companies, including Target, Lululemon Athletica, and Cartier-owned Richemont, provided a sneak peek on the season this week when they released sales figures that exceeded their expectation. Target reversed some of the sluggish sales trends that have plagued it since 2022 when it said on Thursday that same-store and digital sales in November and December rose 2% compared with the same period last year. The big box chain released its sales goal for the quarter, which includes January, to 1.5% growth, up from the prediction of flat sales it made when reporting disappointing results in November. At the luxury end, Richemont reported a 10% jump in quarterly sales, triggering a rally in luxury stocks Thursday after its core jewelry division, housing brands such as Cartier and Van Cleef & Arpels, bucked a downturn in demand for high-end goods. Macy's, by contrast, reported disappointing sales for the holiday period, underscoring that not all chains were winners. Buoyancy defied concerns earlier in the year that inflation, a cooling job market, and concerns over the U.S. presidential election would dampen spending this holiday season. In fact, the election of Donald Trump might have had the opposite effect. For Republicans, Trump's return to the White House improved their view of the economy. And the threat of higher tariffs spurred some people to stockpile goods and move up purchases of big-ticket items such as cars and appliances. Many consumers remain selective in their spending, and low-income shoppers don't feel flush, said Mickey Chata, a retail analyst at Moody's Ratings. While overall spending is strong, many are pulling back from pricier non-discretionary products to focus on value and essentials, and the lower-income cohort continues to feel pressure, he said. Retailers on an upswing continue to gather pace. Lululemon Athletic raised its guidance for the fourth quarter, predicting growth of 11% to 12%. Urban Outfitters said net sales for November and December jumped 10%. Investors had been unforgiving of any slip-ups. Although Abercrombie & Fitch reported strong sales, its stock fell when profit margins failed to live up to analysts' expectations. Abercrombie expects net sales for the year-end period to increase 7-8%, which was above prior estimates, but it isn't expecting the upside to operating margins, which drove shares down more than 15% on Monday. Citi analyst Paul Lejeune said that Abercrombie executives who spoke on Monday at a financial conference in Orlando, Florida, said the lack of margin upside was due more to incremental marketing spending than heightened promotions. Macy's had warned of weaker revenue in the crucial year-end period, saying it expects net sales to come in at the low end or slightly below its previous guided range of $7.8 billion to $8 billion. Signet Jewelers cut its fourth quarter outlook after holiday sales fell short of expectations. Jewelry retailer's chief financial officer, Joan Hilson, said Tuesday that consumers shifted to lower-priced gifts. That was Holiday Spending Cheers Retailers. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. If you miss any part of this program or any other of our great broadcasts, you can stream it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Now, let's go on to our next article. TSMC logs record quarter as AI surges, by Sherry Chin. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company reported another record quarter on AI-driven demand for chips and said it expects continued growth even as it navigates the U.S.-China technology rivalry. The world's largest contract chip maker on Thursday guided for mid-20% growth in sales this year on strong artificial intelligence demand. Artificial intelligence will likely remain a long-term growth catalyst for TSMC, driven by the continued global investment in AI infrastructure. Deutsche Bank analyst Robert Sanders said in a recent note that the Taiwanese company's sales growth will be closely tied to NVIDIA, which could account for 18% of TSMC's sales in 2025. TSMC Chairman and Chief Executive C.C. Wei said revenue from AI-related servers and processors is expected to double in 2025 after more than tripling last year to account for 18% of its total revenue. The company thinks the AI momentum has just begun and its long-term revenue compound annual growth rate could reach 20% even on 2024's high base as the technology becomes more widely deployed. The chipmaker's fourth quarter net profit jumped 57% to 374.68 billion new Taiwan dollars, equivalent to 11.37 billion U.S. dollars, topping analysts' expectation in a FactSet poll. Revenue rose 39% from a year earlier to new Taiwan dollars 868.46 billion for the quarter, with the gross margin climbing to 59%. Last year, sales of Taiwan-listed TSMC soared more than 80% on robust AI-related demand. The index heavyweight helped Taiwan become the best-performing major Asian market in 2024 with a 28% gain. TSMC's been expanding its footprint abroad, building factories in Japan and the U.S. The company expects the ramp-up of overseas facilities to dilute its gross margin, forecasting first-quarter margin at 57 to 59%. That was TSMC logs record quarter as AI surges. Up next, Amex is fined for deceptive card sales tactics by Anna Maria Andriotis. American Express has agreed to pay approximately $230 million in penalties over deceptive practices tied to how it sold credit cards and wire services to small business customers. The settlement included a $108.7 million civil penalty from the Justice Department and a non-prosecution agreement with the Eastern District of New York over a criminal investigation into some of its practices. The company also has reached an agreement in principle with its regulators at the Federal Reserve that it expects will be completed in the coming weeks. The Fed matter will result in a penalty that Amex said is included in the roughly $230 million total. The Wall Street Journal was the first to report on these practices with a series of articles about some Amex salespeople strong-arming business owners to boost sales of credit cards and other products, including small business card sales tactics that involved misrepresenting card rewards and fees and checking credit reports without consent. Among the practices that the Journal reported on and the Justice Department cited were Amex's deceptive sales and marketing of wire products that were pitched to customers as being helpful to avoid paying taxes. The card company also was cited for its practice of entering dummy employer identification numbers on small business credit card accounts, a shortcut salespeople use to increase card signups, the Journal reported. Amex said it had cooperated with the agencies and regulators to address the problems, including disciplining staff and changing its organization and training. It said the problems had ended in 2021 or earlier. The problematic card sales practices began when Amex was scrambling to retain Costco small business customers after the warehouse club ended its long-running exclusive partnership with the card company. Small businesses were a particularly valuable slice of the Costco cohort, and the potential revenue hit to Amex from the loss of Costco customers was enormous. Amex launched its aggressive campaign to keep those business card holders, which ushered in an era of escalating sales goals and hefty commissions that persisted at least until the Journal began reporting on the practices in 2020. The Costco retention campaign ended in 2016, but the sales practices didn't, the Journal reported. Salespeople who had grown accustomed to the big commissions from the Costco retention program and had to meet high monthly sales targets continued on with questionable practices, some of which were flagged to higher-ups, the Journal reported. Many of the findings in the U.S. government's probes matched the journal's reporting. For example, Amex employees used dummy employer identification numbers such as 123456788 in opening small business credit cards as part of the Costco retention program. In 2023, Amex agreed to pay $15 million to the Office of Comptroller of the Currency to settle an investigation into some of its business card sales practices that also were tied to the journal's reporting. That was Amex is fined for deceptive card sales tactics. Next up, sales at Cartier owner Richemont beat estimates by Andrea Figueres. Cartier owner Richemont reported better-than-expected quarterly sales, triggering a rally in luxury stocks after its core jewelry division bucked a downturn in demand for high-end goods. The Swiss luxury group said it achieved its highest-yet quarterly sales in the 3 months to December, returning to growth thanks to the strength in its jewelry division, housing heavyweight brands like Cartier and Van Cleef & Arpels, which offset weaker watch sales. Richemont said Thursday that it generated sales of 6.15 billion euros, equivalent to 6.33 billion U.S. dollars, for the 3 months to December 31st, up 10% compared with the prior year period at both actual and constant exchange rates. Sales grew 10% at constant currency, following a 1% decline the prior quarter. The result surpasses analysts' prediction of 5.63 billion euros, according to a poll of estimates compiled by Visible Alpha. The update sent Richemont's shares more than 16% higher at 161.8 Swiss francs, its biggest one-day percentage rise yet. The news also spurred sharp gains across European luxury companies, with Louis Vuitton and Dior owner LVMH jumping more than 9%, and Gucci parent Kering raising more than 6%. Against a backdrop of slowing demand for luxury goods buffeting the sector, particularly in China, analysts saw the Swiss company as a resilient player thanks to its Cartier and Van Cleef & Arpels brands. The company's core jewelry division recorded third-quarter sales of 4.5 billion euros, up 14% on year and ahead of analyst forecasts of 4.11 billion euros. We view these results as exceptionally strong, RBC Capital Markets analysts Pirel Dehania and Nicholas Lafianis said in a note. Richemont is benefiting from strong momentum at Cartier and Van Cleef & Arpels in particular, the analyst said. Richemont's update came just 2 days after Italian luxury firm Brunello Cucinelli said it is positive about its growth plans for the coming year and reported higher-than-expected revenue for the fourth quarter, helped by its well-heeled clientele. Wealthier consumers have continued to indulge in luxuries despite the global slowdown, thanks to their resilience even in times of economic woes. This has led to a polarization of luxury brand performances, with those exposed to these customers faring better than those that rely on less affluent shoppers. Richemont said that sales in the Americas grew 22%, with increases across all businesses areas helped by strong local demand. Barclays analysts had anticipated a potential improvement in U.S. trends due to the absence of uncertainty about the elections, which had previously dragged down consumer spending. Meanwhile, the group's specialist watchmakers division reported an 8% decline in quarterly sales to 867 million euros. This was, however, better than anticipated, as analysts had forecast the sales of only 802 million euros. The watch division has recorded weak results as it's highly exposed to China, a market where luxury companies are struggling with sliding demand as high-end buyers have reduced their spending on pricey goods in light of the country's economic woes. Demand is still challenging in China, Richemont said. The latest data from the Federation of the Swiss Watch Industry showed a continued decline in export of Swiss watches, with those to China and Hong Kong being particularly poor and weighing heavily on the global trend. That was sales at Cartier owner Richemont beat estimates. Next, let's move from watches to TikTok with this article, Trump's Allies Eye Reprieve for TikTok, by Alex Leary, Georgia Wells, and Raphael Hawaii. TikTok gained new hope for survival in America, with its CEO slated to attend Donald Trump's inauguration and the incoming president's advisors working on options to delay a ban of the popular video app. TikTok chief executive Su Chu is expected to sit among the president-elect's high-profile guests as Trump delivers his inaugural address on Monday, according to people familiar with the matter. And that will put him in the company of influential U.S. tech leaders who are planning to attend, including billionaire Trump advisor Elon Musk, Amazon.com executive chairman Jeff Bezos, Google CEO Sundar Pichai, Apple CEO Tim Cook, and OpenAI CEO Sam Altman, as well as Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of TikTok rival Meta Platforms. The ceremony promises to be a stunning illustration of the tech industry's embrace of the new president and a stark reflection of Trump's about-face on the face of TikTok, which he sought to evict from the U.S. in his first term before warming to it in recent years. The situation was evolving quickly, with both the planned ban and Trump's inauguration just days away, and a last-minute reprieve for TikTok was far from a done deal. Under a law passed with a broad bipartisan support by Congress and signed by President Biden last year, TikTok will be banned in the U.S. on Sunday unless its Beijing-based parent, ByteDance, divests itself of the operation. Trump's advisors are reviewing the law to find ways to push back the deadline, according to people involved in the discussion. Representative Mike Waltz, Republican of Florida, Trump's pick to lead the National Security Council, said in an interview on Fox News on Thursday that Trump's team plans to put pressure in place to keep TikTok from going dark. President Trump has repeatedly expressed his desire to save TikTok, and there's no better dealmaker than Donald Trump, Trump transition spokeswoman Caroline Levitt said. The New York Times earlier reported that Chu would attend the inauguration. Some legal scholars said Trump's ability to delay the TikTok ban is limited under the law, though the incoming president could proceed anyway. The federal law permits Biden to extend the January 19th divestiture deadline by 90 days if there is significant progress toward a sale backed by legally binding agreements. Past that point, Trump can also lift the ban if his administration determines there is interagency process that TikTok is no longer under Chinese control. He can also refuse to enforce its restrictions and give assurances to Google, Apple, and Oracle that they won't face fines for violating the statute. Just days before Biden leaves office, administration officials said their reading of the law indicates that the White House doesn't have the statutory authority to delay its implementation, but they don't intend to enforce the ban before leaving office. The Supreme Court is weighing its constitutionality, and last week seemed inclined to let it stand. Barring a Supreme Court intervention or some 11th-hour move by the Biden administration to formally defer the law, TikTok plans to go dark in the U.S. when the clock strikes midnight on Saturday night, according to a person familiar with its plan. Otherwise, the company's partners involved in supporting the app in the U.S. could still face risk under the law, the person said. But that outage could be brief if President Trump proceeds with an executive order. The impending ban prompted a scramble on Capitol Hill, where some lawmakers who backed the law last year were now looking for an escape hatch. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, said Thursday that Democrats wanted to work to keep TikTok up and running. That was Trump's Allies Eye Reprieve for TikTok. Next, new cyber rules aimed to thwart attacks, by James Rundle. President Biden on Thursday issued a sweeping executive order on cybersecurity, covering topics from securing federal communications against foreign hackers to threats posed by artificial intelligence and quantum computing. The order, which comes just days before Biden leaves office, contains deadlines stretching far into President-elect Donald Trump's administration, raising questions as to whether it will survive the change at the White House come Monday. The order includes provisions covering security of software supply chains, increased sanctions power against nations and individuals, using AI in cyber defense and developing quantum-resistant encryption, hardening federal communications, strengthening digital identities, and bolstering federal cybersecurity. The White House has spent the past 7 months studying some of the worst cyber attacks to hit U.S. companies and the federal government under the Biden administration. This includes the compromise of private keys in Microsoft systems, the hack of Viasat on the eve of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and the intrusion of Chinese hackers into critical infrastructure systems. In each case, said Ann Neuberger, Deputy National Security Advisor for Cybersecurity, the government studied how the hackers succeeded and crafted the executive order to attack the root of those issues. That was New Cyber Rules Aim to Thwart Attacks. Next, Zyn Nicotine Pouches Are Cleared for Sale by Laura Cooper. The U.S. Health Officials cleared America's most popular nicotine pouch to stay on the market, saying Zyn's benefit as a safer alternative for adult cigarette smokers outweighed its potential risk to young people. The Food and Drug Administration said Philip Morris International's Zyn pouches pose lower risk of cancer and other serious health conditions than cigarettes or traditional dipping tobacco. The agency said it reviewed data on the risk to young people and found that youth use of nicotine pouches remains low, despite growing sales of the pouches in recent years. Zyn's skyrocketing sales last year landed in the middle of the culture wars, with liberals raising alarm bells that it was attracting teenagers and conservatives touting it as a way to save smokers' lives. In a nationwide survey of American students, 6% of 12th graders said they had at least used a nicotine pouch in the past year, up from 3% a year earlier. Though still a small percentage of the overall population, the increase has alarmed some public health groups. Tom Hayes, president of Swedish Match North America, a subsidiary of Philip Morris, said the FDA's decision was, quote, an important step to protect the public health by providing better alternatives to cigarettes and other traditional tobacco products for adults 21 and older. In the U.S., Zyn is available in flavors including mint, cinnamon, coffee, and citrus, and comes in two nicotine strengths, 3 milligrams and 6 milligrams. Public health groups have expressed concerns about the lack of federal marketing restrictions on nicotine pouches. Zyn has advertised on late-night TV and on outdoor signs. Federal authorization of 20 Zyn products comes with new restrictions for television, digital, and radio advertising to ensure ads are targeting to adults or 21 and older. The FDA said Philip Morris has committed not to use actors or models under 35 years old. The agency added that it would closely monitor Zyn's marketing. It's critical that the manufacturer market these products responsibly to prevent youth use, said Brian King, director of the FDA's Center for Tobacco Products. Nicotine pouches look like small tea bags that tuck between the gum and cheek and are filled with wood pulp along with nicotine salts, artificial sweeteners, and flavorings. They're comparable in risk to pharmaceutical products such as nicotine gums or patches, public health researchers have said. Zyn has been available for sale in the U.S. since 2014. The brand's sales grew after Philip Morris acquired the brand in 2022 and expanded distribution. Scores of unofficial Zynfluencers began promoting the nicotine pouches on social media. Zinn became popular so quickly that its only U.S. factory couldn't keep up with the demand. Fans dubbed the resulting shortages the Zindemic. Philip Morris added capacity at its factory in Owensboro, Kentucky, and last quarter said the shortages were easing. Philip Morris next reports earnings on February 6th. That was Zinn nicotine pouches are cleared for sale. Next, let's turn to the opinion pages of the journal and begin with this item. Trump can make Russia pay to rebuild Ukraine, by Neil Ferguson and Chris Miller. Mr. Ferguson is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and the author of Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. Mr. Miller is a professor of international history at Tufts University and non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. The key to securing Europe at less cost to U.S. taxpayers may be sitting in European bank accounts. The West has frozen around $300 billion of Russian foreign exchange assets, but European obstinacy has prevented these funds from being used to compensate Ukraine for war damages. President-elect Trump should insist that the Kremlin's reserves be mobilized to fund Ukraine's reconstruction and future arms purchases. Russia has caused more than $150 billion in direct damage to Ukraine and nearly $500 billion in economic losses, according to the World Bank. Ukraine will need external funds of this magnitude to rebuild and more in the meantime to rearm itself with continued purchases of Western weapons. Mr. Trump doesn't want the U.S. to foot this bill, especially with America's military already spread thin in the Middle East and Asia. European budgeters are planning to increase their own defense spending, as Mr. Trump demands, so they'll be stretched thin as well. The obvious solution is to use the frozen assets. The Group of Seven has already agreed to tap the profits from interest produced by the frozen assets. But because of European opposition, aided and abetted by the inept diplomacy of the Biden administration, tapping these profits unlocked only a $50 billion loan for Ukraine and left the underlying assets untouched. This isn't enough. Five factors make now the ideal time to use these funds to compensate Russia's victims. The first is Mr. Trump's return to the White House. President Biden always accepted the lowest common denominator among allies, letting foot-dragging leaders such as Germany's Olaf Scholz offer speeches rather than substance. Mr. Trump knows how to exert leverage, and Europeans know that if they don't act, he'll turn the screws. Second, the assets have changed. When the war started, most Russian reserves were in the form of foreign government securities held by European custodians. Now, according to the Hoover Institution's Philip Zyklow, the securities have largely matured into cash. Up to a third may be held in dollars or British pounds, potentially giving Washington and London the ability to act unilaterally. Third, it's clear that the reserves can be mobilized in ways consistent with international law. Ukraine is owed reparations from Russia. Lee Buchheit, an expert in sovereign asset law, proposed in 2023 that Western countries could lend to Ukraine cash reserved by Kyiv's right to receive these reparations. Assuming Russia refuses to pay, the West could set off the foreign reserves against this obligation. Alternately, Mr. Zyklow proposes moving the assets to a trust fund to compensate Ukraine for war damages, the same way that Saddam Hussein's foreign reserves were used to rebuild Kuwait after the Gulf War. Allied powers did something similar after the World Wars, using German assets to pay for reparations. The European excuse that international law prohibits moving on the reserves no longer holds water. Fourth, Russia has less ability to retaliate economically. Any assets that Western firms still own in Russia are increasingly beyond their control. Income is difficult or impossible to repatriate. The Kremlin is already using strong-arm measures against these firms, and in most cases, they've already written down their value. Moscow can't do much more damage than it already has. Fifth, many European governments are finally warming to the idea. Europeans realize that Ukraine needs a long-term source of funds, and change is coming in the most important country, Germany. Mr. Scholz will likely be replaced in February by Friedrich Merz, who has rightly criticized Mr. Scholz's bare minimum support for Ukraine. Mr. Merz has yet to take a stand on the foreign assets question, but mobilizing Russia's reserves would fit with his vision and his need to address Mr. Trump's insistence that Europe contribute more to its own security. The Trump administration has a unique opportunity to strike a better deal. Both sides of the Atlantic would benefit from transferring Mr. Putin's cash to the victims of his aggression. The sooner, the better. That was, Trump can make Russia pay to rebuild Ukraine. And finally, this from the Journal's editorial board. Mike Pence's truth bomb in Hong Kong. For a mild-mannered guy, Mike Pence packed a punch. On Thursday, speaking in Hong Kong at the UBS Wealth Insights Summit, the former vice president called for the release of the newspaperman Jimmy Lai, whose trial on national security charges was also taking place in another part of the city. There is probably no more compelling gesture in the short term to send a message of goodwill to the people of the United States or the free world than if China were to take steps to free Jimmy Lai, Mr. Pence said. It says something about today's Hong Kong that stating this is controversial. One of the charges against Mr. Lai is an allegation that he met with the then-VP in 2019 to lobby for U.S. sanctions. Mr. Pence denies it. Jimmy Lai did not ask for U.S. sanctions or any action against Hong Kong or China, he recently told us. If Mr. Lai is prosecuted for proximity to Mr. Pence, are the business leaders at this week's summit at risk? Marco Rubio, nominated to be the next Secretary of State, said in his confirmation hearings that Beijing has broken all the guarantees it made to Hong Kong. The big question for the city is how it can claim to be a global financial and trade center when it holds political prisoners and can confiscate a newspaper from its owner without so much as a court order. The authorities encourage conferences to send a message of business as usual. They're helped to promote speakers who show up, offer platitudes, and collect fat speaking fees. Mr. Pence opted instead to speak a hard truth on Hong Kong soil. The Chinese and Hong Kong governments would do well to put aside their irritation that he did so. Donald Trump will be sworn in Monday as U.S. president. He's pledged to free Jimmy Lai, and a bipartisan U.S. consensus is forming against China and Hong Kong. Mr. Pence's remarks are a warning about what's to come if they don't fix the mess they created. That was Mike Pence's truth bomb in Hong Kong. And that brings us to the end of today's Wall Street Journal for Friday, January 17th, 2025. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for more interesting programming right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.